1,500 cc per liter. Are you going to be inducted in the initialization of two chips for curriculum implementation? The 409 schools are taken care of by a group of people we've chosen called change agents. So change agents have been recruited from the ranks of retired circuit managers and principals who have a history of success. So we found a way of bringing them back into the sector, and we've given them on average between five and ten schools for them to support quite closely. So them to understand their needs and support them. And those schools are part of the sector school. So between them, I mean, they've already made a good, over 1,600, in fact, under 1,700, 7 days worth of school visits. We have also been working with the Department of Rural Development and Land Affairs, the Department and the DBSA, to design a model for renovating schools using interns who have qualifications in construction. And we've already renovated some 5 schools using this model. The Department of Rural Development and Land Affairs is a database of interns who are used to renovate the school. So they pay them the stipends, they give them protective clothing, and therefore give them, in this way, an opportunity for them to pick up practical skills. So we have a plan to replicate that model across about 30% of the first start schools. And we've been talking to the private sector about them supporting this model. We have a limit of about 500,000 to buy material. Which material is bought locally, and the Department of Rural Development brings the intern, the Department of Education helps us to project manage that and do renovations in that sense. And in fact, there's some pictures on some of the renovations that these young people have done, which are done in a very cost-effective way. The important thing about these renovations is that they are done in the context of a more comprehensive education improvement agenda. So these schools don't only receive the renovations, they only receive inputs into the classroom. We also talk to them about how to take care of this infrastructure. So in many sense, I mean, even fresh starts that we spoke about earlier on. And there's some bit of details about the learning programs which I will not go into, and I've already cited those, but as one of the interventions. The slide about the development of the 3-year plan gives you a sense of the choices in terms of approaches that each of those districts and provinces are choosing or are making, because we can't, as the NECC, do everything, but have to choose specific change theories and approaches that we will take to support the implementation of the broader reform agenda. In terms of the work that is being done, planned for, we have organized it into 7 areas with a heavy focus on teacher performance, as you can see, 30% on teacher performance and another 30% on school management and the rest of the other inputs. So those parameters have been set to ensure that there are common threads that run across those 8 districts, which are suggested in with some level of flexibility for the respective districts to finalize their inputs differently. In terms of systemic intervention, the trust agreed to help the department to look at issues of teacher provision, and we are still in a scoping phase on that one. We've been talking to the Limpopo Department of Education and the Northwest Department of Education. We're pleased actually on talking to the Northwest Department of Education to actually discover that the Northwest Department is already down the road in sorting out some of the teacher provision issues. And they're very interesting approaches that they are taking, like from better managing leave and managing more efficiently managing the seed nettings and so on and so forth, which will contribute to the better management of seed provisioning. Innovation, we've received many, many suggestions and proposals from NGOs and the private sector and key players in the sector on innovation projects that we could be embarking on. You know, obviously we don't have unlimited resources in terms of time and money, and therefore we have to make hard choices on what we focus on, and in particular focus on those things that are linked to the reform agenda, but in any case which would help prepare for the future as a nation. So the first project that we have taken on board is about understanding how the national examination system has improved to such an efficient system today, you know, as it compared to post, you know, 1994, when there were many problems, you know, from setting of those papers, leaking of the papers, to not knowing whether we'll get the results and so on. So we think that, you know, as a nation, it's important to drive a learning agenda, and we should learn from our own experiences and where, you know, necessary and fitting, we should celebrate the successes that we as a nation have, achieved. So that project, you know, seeks to do that. We've been talking to people who are in the examination system, and some of them have left to pick out what could be the things that actually resulted in such an improvement of the subsystem. The second project is a test project for a referral system, and we've chosen a circuit in Iwomba, the Bilabia circuit, to test how we could, you know, optimally a screen and refer learners with a psychosocial need, and this is linked to theme 6 of the national, of the themes that I spoke about. So again, the approach here is to bring key players to work together and to drive this, you know, a screening process a quick, you know, more swiftly. So we've brought in the universities of Limpopo, the Medical University of South Africa, the University of Pretoria, and of course the Department of Health, the local hospital there, and some NGOs to work on a model that we are testing to see how partners will be working together to support that agenda. The third is, involves the work that we have started with the department to consolidate the ICT planning and planning which would enable us to better coordinate the ICT or resources that are investment in the ICT space. So whether it's direct, you know, financial or material resources, or the planning from the private sector in terms of the provision of bandwidth and so on, or the Department of Telecoms and Postal Services. And I'm delighted to say that the Deputy Minister and my Chairman, Mr. Nathan, have arranged a meeting with the Minister of Postal Services and Telecommunications to talk about a strengthened collaboration. We will first and foremost focus on the A districts and then, you know, expand that to the rest. We think that that will give us a good opportunity to test, you know, how we can, in a more, you know, collaborated and high dosage, you know, collaborated and provide high dosage interventions in these districts. So local projects, we have embarked on a project with the department to assess, you know, how we can better design and implement math and science interventions in the system. I'm sure all of us will know that this country is awash with math and science interventions, which are in the main initiated by the private sector. The truth is that many of the people who drive corporate social investment in the private sector are teachers, and neither are they a math and science specialist. So often, you know, they design these interventions without a good understanding of what it takes to run effective health and science interventions. So the NECG and the department have decided to review a number of these evaluation projects to see whether we can come up with guidelines which we can use to inform the interventions in that respect. The fifth program is a dialogue program, and it follows through from the very dialogue that saw to the establishment of the Education Collaboration Trust. The purpose of the dialogue is to create an avenue for open, honest engagement among key stakeholders such as government, teacher unions, student organizations, civil society organizations, business, academic, research, government. I keep putting government as part of stakeholders, and often I get questions whether government is a stakeholder. No, but you know, in that respect, as partners. So we've had two dialogues in the past 12 months, national dialogues in the past 12 months, and one provincial dialogue, all of which focused on, you know, how to improve the professionalization of teaching, with very interesting inputs from different perspectives, you know, as religious leaders or traditional leaders and business, the unions themselves. And the interesting thing is that, you know, that phase, you know, helps to calibrate the expectations and the perspectives that the different stakeholders play. We think that we seriously need that kind of space. And in fact, it should remain the lifeblood of the NDP. So we as the South Africans should continue to talk about what's important towards the implementation of the NDP and achieving those targets, 50-50 targets that have been created. We have participated in the World Teachers Day campaign. In fact, for the whole month, we've been working with the department, all the unions, ELRC, and the South African Council of Educators to drive a message about placing our own teachers in the right, you know, place in this country. And at least, you know, redirecting the constant and continuous castigation of teachers, because not all teachers are bad. In fact, if we are to win over the confidence and cooperation of teachers, we have to, you know, find space to engage in positive and constructive narratives. We don't think that this project should be left to other peoples or other strategies that may have been used in other countries. South Africa has a peculiar history, and I think we think that we should draw from the peculiar history to win over our teachers fully in order for them to take care of the important task of educating our children. So, you know, going forward, we're going to consolidate the recommendations from the discussions that we've had, and we have agreed to explore, what will be the schooling model of the future for South Africa. And we think that those three members that represent the different stakeholders are better placed to start talking about what kind of schooling of the future we want to have. Lastly, program 8, and I skipped programs 6 and 7, which are 6 internal, you know, operations of governance and finances and human resources and so on, which the trust is taking care of, and some strategic partnerships, and I've spoken about the strategic partnerships throughout the presentation. The 8th program is monitoring and evaluation. It was important that we set up very tight monitoring and evaluation frameworks, which amongst others, have a provision for an independent advisory body that works with the trust. And Professor John Bolnick, who has been chair of Umalusi for the second time, Professor Sarah Howe, who is from University of Victoria, Dr. Martin Gustafson, who was in the department, and Emmanuel Banda, a statistician from Umalusi, have been pulled together into an advisory committee which advises the trust on issues of monitoring and evaluation. And we set out a framework for the monitoring and evaluation and a set of activities, monitoring and evaluation activities that will run, you know, throughout the implementation of the program. And in the main, we'll run those monitoring and evaluation activities using independent, you know, a service provider, on the basis of which we're going to report back to the key stakeholders on whether or not we've done what we said we'll do, and the extent to which these interventions are helping us move towards set outcomes. So, Chairperson, that's about the background of the NACT, and that's how far we've gone. And I believe that my colleagues from the department, the DG and his colleagues, would be in a better place to make inputs where necessary, because we work quite closely in the design and the implementation of this program. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Mr. Kotsong. It was a very informative presentation. And again, thank you very much for the interest that all these stakeholders have shown towards improving the education in South Africa. And indeed, we are continuing to make a presentation listing all these stakeholders, labor, business, and such. It does say, indeed, as government, we cannot achieve whatever goals we have if all these other stakeholders does not come to party into party to make sure that they deliver is done. So it really reminds me when the ruling party is saying together we can do more, together we can move South Africa forward. It's one of the things that you are seeing that is happening to make sure that we deliver quality education to our nation. That was the presentation, honourable members. I know you might having a question and comments on the presentation. Can I then open this to you if ever there are any interactions you want to have with the CEO of the I'll just note him, and yeah, we'll still have about 20 minutes. I'll start with Honorable Kilian, Honorable Lovemore, so that I don't forget, Honorable Oshoff, Honorable Khoza, in that order.
Thank you, Chairperson. Chairperson, I do want to say that it was indeed a very informative presentation, and I think it is for all South Africans who realize that we have to all make contributions in different ways to correcting what is wrong. I think it's really exciting to have this sort of intervention. Chairperson, I have followed very carefully what the phases are, and I think it is just fantastic to have a new approach from the private sector as well, and to work in collaboration with government. But just a little more information about your themes for action. The slide that referred to learner welfare is part of the program to also look at the poverty and the problems that are crippling certain communities and are in fact having an impact on education, and how do we involve social services and the other sectors to ensure learner welfare. Then secondly, just a question about the important role for professionalization of education and ensuring that It is seen as a career of choice, the role of the union, etc. But if I could just want to ask you the commitment of all those role players, in particular in certain of the provinces, we've had some difficulties. Now that brings me to your sample that was selected, the 8 districts. And it makes good sense that it's because private sector normally makes investments in housing and Western Cape. It is true for all other infrastructure projects as well. So it's good that it is redirected to our rural provinces where we in fact battle in certain provinces. And I'm happy to see that Limpopo is there, that we have the Eastern Cape, and KwaZulu-Natal, Northwest and Mpumalanga. Obviously, I suppose Northern Cape, because of its scarcity, the population spread, which is very thin, was not exactly the right place to start. But obviously, we also have to move parents and all of the communities and role players in that province. But I suppose that comes later. Now, your selection of the schools and the number of schools, I just have a little bit of a concern. Eastern Cape is one of the biggest components in the sector. And if I look at, if we look at the 18%, but if we look at the relative small number of schools, I understand that you've selected deliberately rural area, Libode and Mount Frere. But was it not perhaps important to also expand the district footprint in the Eastern Cape further? And would you also consider going forward expanding in our rural provinces the impact of this collaboration? Thank you, Jefferson.
Thank you, Jefferson, and thank you for the presentation. I don't fully understand how this is aligned with the NDP. The NDP talks about two interventions. It talks about political pact, and then it talks about technical mobilization. The technical mobilization, as described in the NDP, is not what is happening now. So, but I'm just interested in whether you see this as part of the technical mobilization. How do you see the work that you're doing as aligning with what the NDP has actually outlined should be done? There was quite a bit of talk in the presentation towards the end about the teacher professionalization campaign, which I'm always very pleased to hear of. But, Chair, in the NDP, there are a number of very specific requirements, such as competency tests for teachers, such as unions not being involved in teacher appointments at all. I'm interested to know what your teacher professionalization campaign comprises. I'd like to just get an idea of, I don't quite know how to put this, but the structure of the NECT in terms of cost, how much money are we talking about here? Who plans what will be done? I don't see a structure. What I'm very concerned about is that DBE is clearly allocating money and resources currently to the work done by NECT, and it's outside, it sounds like, of the allocations that we are normally informed of. But I'm also concerned that that DBE and provincial departments will become reliant on the NECT, and there's no requirement that you remain committed. There's no requirement that you remain committed. Businesses can take their money elsewhere. So I just want to get some idea of the structure. Quickly, Chair, whether you as NECT have looked at current very functional NGO operations. And let me give you one example. There's an NGO which calls itself Partners for Possibility, which gets businesses involved to fund training of principals and also have business managers mentor principals. It's a very functional and very effective NGO. Do you utilize, have you explored the possibility of funding NGOs that are already involved in the education sector and doing fantastic work? And then just finally, Chair, a very specific question. You spoke about 2,000 stakeholders and the various dialogues that have been held, etc. We, certainly the political parties, at the beginning you said the political parties that were available for comment or to be involved, nobody actually asked us. My question actually, though, is where can we find the outcomes of the dialogues? Where are they? On which website are they posted? Thank you, Chair.
Okay. Thank you very much, Madam Chair. Most of the questions have been asked. If I can just refer you to Innovation Program P3, Project Number 3, Develop a Coherent and Affordable Implementation Program with regard to ICT, etc. What are we going to do with regard to the rural schools? Many of these schools don't even have electricity. So how do you implement an ICT system at these schools? Thank you very much.
Thank you, Jefferson. Mine is in relation to the parent and community involvement vis-a-vis the learner welfare. I want to couple that with the role of media in terms of projecting good practices that are taking place in trying to address the shortcomings that have been identified. I think as a country, we have a role to educate our communities, more especially in the rural areas, to take part in the education of the child. Because many times, the learners are left in the hands of the teachers alone, without the communities taking part in trying to assist the educators. So my submission here is to say, country, redirect our efforts in terms of identifying all those retired stakeholders or retired educators who have been influential and have shown a kind of success in their daily activities to come back and educate our rural communities, to take education as a very key aspect that can assist the country and uplift the economy of the country. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. The CP that we have got stakeholders who want to make a very great impact to make a education a success in South Africa. Looking at the way they put their presentation, there's also an emphasis in the maths and English, if I have never read the other slides well, but particularly maths. And with that, we have got the lesson after looking at other research that we have done here. There's a research that we have done there where you've seen maths educators having low input or whatever in quality. What we have for the teacher welfare, because in rural areas, what really happens, we have a mass movement of those teachers don't stay because of the welfare. Maybe if you want more information about it, I can continue saying what do I need for welfare. All those things.
Thank you. And I'd like to know if there is a risk management plan in place, but also taking into consideration that financial resources are scarce, I'd like to find out from Mr. Khoza on what is the sustainability of this initiative. It is a good initiative, but I'd like to know also in terms of feasibility studies, this is going to be sustainable. And also to understand the role of the unions, because I know this is a partnership, it's a collaboration between business and government, the community and labor. I'd like to know, I know in your input the emphasis was on partnership with business with focus on funding. And then I'd like to know the role of the unions in assisting with the actual implementation of this initiative. It is a good initiative. I'd like to know if it's going to be sustained. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Together with the department, because we are working with the department
yes, this this good initiative, we might not have seen NEC for quite a long time, we don't know, but working together with the department now, there are areas that have been identified, of which, at the end, you should always remain with the department. They always be accountable. When you read your presentations, we have come up with challenges like the issue of leaders. There are not enough at schools. The department must come to play. What is it that, you know, what is it that has been done? We have come up with the, with 10, like the change agents. You are bringing back old teachers or bad teachers and whatever. For me, we don't wish to see the department now being wholly dependent on what is happening. You know, what will happen when we move out? What is it that the department is learning? What is it that the department is taking from all these challenges that we have picked up to make sure that that gap is closed even when the NCC is no more there? Because we wish to see the department standing on its own again. Yes, we'll always be in need of this supplementary assistance that we are coming up with. In whatever intervention that you are coming up with. For me, again, we always say the department knows very well that we always say most of the time when we look at the budget level, that is always the weakest link, and I hear that you have to be to make sure that you help in having the work of the department. But really, if the DG or anyone from the department can help us to say, yes, we see the NEC going out, are we going to see the department saying on its feet, or we are going to go back to them? But otherwise, really, the interventions that you're coming up with are very good. The issues of fresh start schools, I think, it's one of the very good and important concepts that we have mentioned. And we always say, as the portfolio committee, that is the information we always need, even when we do our oversight. That is one of the things now when we go to this district to make sure what's the difference, what has been the effect and the impact of this intervention when we go to those schools, those districts that have not been performing. I know there is so much information that we need from you after this for our own consumption and to help us now in our oversight role. But really, this is much appreciated. I know you don't have much of time now, but surely you are going to take those questions to the other department that will respond on the issues that are not going to be left off. Then, over to you.
Well, thank you, Jay. I will, you know, respond to the questions, but just perhaps to say that the questions put together, I mean, helped me to establish the heartbeat of the country. So, I know that these are sort of concerns and views that the committee has, which represents the country. The questions by Honorable Killian, you know, starting with a poverty, which is crippling, we know it's crippling, you know, schools. But, you know, as I said, we have to make careful choices. And in fact, the worst a claim or decision to make would have been to see ourselves as government. So we are not government, and we have the government, which is continuing to do work. So the work of the collaborative work under the NECT is meant to fast track some of those, reform activities. Nevertheless, in each of those schools that we work in, our main approach is to help the schools find solutions. So some of the poverty-related, issues and challenges can be addressed by the Department of Social Development and so on. The first is, you've got to know the challenge. The second is, where would you get help? And how do you get that, relevant, assistance to deal with the challenge? The second question about the professionalization and the level of commitment of stakeholders. I think the key stakeholders are government, union, business, and civil society. And I'm sure your question is about the commitment of the union. So, business, I think, has been fully committed. The evidence to that is that the trilogue estimates that business spends, about 2 or 3 years ago, spent about between three and about 6 billion rand in education. So that for me is the commitment of business, you know, to, you know, the whole professionalization and partnering education improvement. But as you know, practically, I mean, some of that investment is for marketing purposes. And the role that the NECT is playing is directing those typically marketing-related investments into genuine education improvement investments. Right? So the teachers union, I would comment also on a personal basis. I think speaking to all the teachers unions, there is a high level of commitment from the executives on the professionalization of teaching. But I think we have to, as a nation, you know, understand, you know, take into account the history, you know, of this country. We will not leave it to the union leaders on their own to convince more of their members to support this, you know, a project or agenda. So the NECT plays the role of facilitating the buying in of more members, you know, teachers to this whole project of professionalization. And if we did that, I think we give the union executives more confidence to drive the process more, you know, faster. Selecting schools in the Eastern Cape. So our unit of selection has been districts. So the reason why you see smaller number of schools in the Eastern Cape is because the Eastern Cape districts are small. So two districts would have amounted to smaller number of schools. I think we should not rush too fast into taking more districts. Part of what we're doing is rebuilding confidence by the key stakeholders and business in particular to get involved in education. So I think the more confidence we build, the more confident we will ourselves to take on more schools from, you know, difficult situations such as the UK. So the structure of the NECT and the allocation of the department's you know, budget and the requirements for sustainability. The story of the NECT, it's actually not to create new resources. The story of the NECT is to utilize the resources that are being used in the sector to concentrate the interventions in, firstly, in a smaller number of schools, smaller number of districts, where we all work together. So, it's, you know, from business. I mean, corporate social investment, we're not asking them to, you know, increase their corporate social investment, you know, budget, but to redirect those to these priority areas. And that's exactly the same way we're working with the Department of Basic Education, the Department of Social Development, Environmental Affairs, and so on. We say, this thing that we've been doing all over the show, can we try and concentrate them in the aid so that in a shorter space of time, we know that we've covered a lot of ground together. Partners for Possibility, we know them. We you know, work with them. In fact, one of their executives, you know, chaired one of the dialogue, you know, sessions. And we've looked at their model. And we've agreed, you know, to collaborate in finding resources to help them implement that. But the partners in education model work well in urban areas or close to urban areas. Very few executives want to leave the urban, you know, the towns and cities to go to the hinterland in the Eastern Cape to mentor and coach a principal. So while it's a good, you know, model, I mean, there's limitations, but we're working together on, you know, how to see how best we can exploit that. The dialogue reports are on the website, and I'm here to send them, you know, to you through your chair. I will send, you know, packages. Honorable Boshoff, on ICTs in rural areas, I mean, the low levels, I mean, no, the absence of you know, connection in some of the schools, it's obviously a structural constraint. But those structural constraints go beyond electricity. They also go in as far as connectivity is concerned. I mean, there are three areas of this country that, you know, connectivity is either too weak or no connectivity at all. The best we can do is to have a master plan which Vodacom can look at, you know, at, which the Department of Education can look at, which public, you know, work can look at, to try and deal with these structural constraints in a collaborative way, and we're working towards that. You know, Honorable Costa, and I did say Costa, not Costa. you won't be more correct about the role of media. I mean, we're nudging media, I mean, to play a constructive role in the implementation of this project I've spoken about. You know, as you know, no news is good news. So media will try to go for the bad news, but we're working with them to put out some of the positive and constructive stories that will take the country forward. The issue of our, you know, retired teachers, we have started. I mean, and, you know, we are careful in selecting the 32 change agents that we have at the moment. And all of them are people who have long experiences and histories of success, either at school or second level. So we've gone to get them amongst, you know, many others, some of whom may not be good. And I must say that we remunerated them at a fraction of what they used to earn whilst they still in the system. So it's a model that's emerging. And hopefully at some point we'll be able to, expand such a model, but based on the tests, you know, that we would have done. Honorable Mbuni, teacher welfare, we know that teacher welfare, you know, plays a big role. It's not one of the core project activities that we've focused on, but we have been discussing these sort of things, whether it's a level of indebtedness of teachers or health-related or long distances and so on. But at this point, it just doesn't happen to be one of the core activities. I think as a matter of principle, we will have to be very careful about, you know, what we choose to focus on, because clearly there are many things to do in this space. And from the chairs, we have a risk, you know, register. Honorable Costa, which part of the first part of which looks at a broader kind of developmental risks in the sector, and we presented those as success conditions. So, which is the more positive way of presenting risks. So we said, in order for us to succeed in implementing interventions in each of those things, what are the success conditions? And so it happens that, you know, issues of teacher assessment and whatnot and so on have been listed as success conditions. And we continue to talk to, you know, the unions about these sorts of, you know, aspects. So when I send the education collaboration framework, you'll see that under professionalization, teacher assessment, for instance, is one of the success conditions. Taking into account the history, I mean, I think we have to be a bit more innovative about how we secure these success conditions. Secondly, I mean, we don't think that we are there to force anything on anybody, but we think that we are there to facilitate achievement of a common vision, an agreement on some key fundamentals that will help, you know, take the process forward. The limited involvement of stakeholders, for instance, has been flagged as a risk, and that's why we set up the disciplinary committees, and we continue to talk to the key stakeholders, including the unions, the business, you know, through BLSA, because without continued involvement of these stakeholders, the NCT work would not continue. Sustainability is a very important aspect. We started thinking about sustainability right from the word go, and we think that the systems and new approaches and tools that are being developed would ever be there in the system. And the whole process of developing these systems and tools, it's a build on what we have done in the past, you know, 20, 30, 40 years. So in a sense, we're adding on to the knowledge repository of the country going forward. It's something that no country should stop developing. The involvement of the NCC contributes to that project in a sense. I mean, I personally think that the pace at which systems improve is also based on the level of hope that the people have. And often we brush this aside. I mean, I think it's a fundamental condition. Success of any development intervention. If people don't believe and don't have hope that this would work. And I think the NCT has contributed to the whole creation of hope and the, adapting of energy to South Africans to work together in implementing a common, program. The commitment of unions again, that was raised. The one positive thing is that all the unions at this point have established their teacher union collaboration program, which focus on a professional development. Well, put aside the extent of the program and the quality of the program, but the fact that all the unions have said we're going to set up our teacher, professional development programs, I think says something about the direction and the pace that they are taking towards, the professionalization of their teachers. And when unions come up with a positive or take these sorts of positive decisions, they need to be supported. As much as we will put our feet on the ground and challenge them when they're not doing constructive things in the sector. So, Chairperson, I've also responded to the issue of what we leave behind. Additional resources, new approaches, new tools, the impact on the current cohort of learners. So the work that we're doing would impact positively on the current cohort of learners, and that's equally important. The learners that we have are the only learners we have now, and the base on which we will create future, workforce and citizens of this country. So I think, that's how the NCT, contributes in this space. Thank you.
Thank you very much for that teaching before we come to
Thank you, Honorable Chair. I'll be brief. 2 points, basically. I think the NCT is involved in Inter-6. The NCT doesn't absolve any provincial department or the national department from its duty to carry out delivering education in the country. And I think what we're looking at is that in the 8 districts that we are in, even if it increases, there are some lessons that are coming out, models and systems, which for the government itself at the provincial and national level needs to be then used by these organs in the remaining districts and when it's rolled out sooner than later. And I think that's what we're looking for, and already there are some interesting lessons that are there that can be implemented almost immediately. The other is we're looking at not to duplicate our area of work but at the end of the day, what we are working on is what APEC's priorities requirement are. And I think one of the usefulness of the NECT is that while we're talking here at the top, it's not a top-down approach. It's also a bottom-up, more than what we usually do as a department as well. So these are some of the lessons we need to take when we go to the other, because we've got 81 to 86 districts to cover. So I think that will be my brief remarks too. Thank you.
Thank you very much, DJ. My co-chair can wrap up and close the session so that we move to another.
Most dangerous thing to offer to me, because then I'll be tempted to ask more questions. But I'm going to like a note. Chair, I really must thank the chairperson and the committee for inviting us to come into this information sharing session. Indeed, it has enriched our knowledge base. We now know what other initiatives are there to assist in taking education to greater heights and connecting us with the world, making also the world to respect us as we accomplish quality education, which is the vision of this government, to have quality education that we believe that sits at the center of this, what is it called, how is it described, this, transformation, what is it, the president described it as a transformation, economic, socio-economic transformation, what? Yes, that's the word, radical transformation. radical socio-economic transformation. Well, we're very pleased to know about your key stakeholders in this task. I want to believe that what keeps you together is a memorandum of understanding, am I right, which must have been signed. And then your pillars, you clearly put your pillars across. You now understand your pillars, which are your core, your areas of cooperation. But what's key to us is that at least we've got these initiatives that are partnering with government in ensuring that they accomplish quality education and taking this nation to great heights. Thank you very much for this information. I think it was wise. You know, thank you for your wisdom for inviting us. Now we know. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you so much, Mr. President. We are now getting to the second session of the day. We'll get a presentation. We're going to have two presentations, the briefing by the Department of Higher Education Training on initial teacher education, and also the report on the research project that has been done by Dr. Nick Taylor. So we are going to present that report. I certainly will allow our two departments, Department of Basic Education, that to open up and hand over to the Department of Higher Education. And you only have 15 minutes for that. After that, we give you over to Dr. Nick Taylor, taking another 20 minutes, then we have two full presentations that are going to be made. But really, we are very much interested in this one. The initial session is one of the pillars from our department. How do you expect to know what we are helping? We want to know what we are doing. So, am I handing over to the DG, not to the DG, but to you, DG. Maybe that's what it is. Before you do that, honorable members, I hope you have the two presentations. Okay. Over to you, Mr. President.
Honorable co-chairpersons, honorable members, DG and colleagues, good morning. I think it is important for us to introduce ourselves as we have arrived late. My name is Themba Gojana. I am the DG responsible for teachers and professional development in the Department of Basic Education. With me, I've got Dr. Dean and Mr. Kutia, who are going to introduce themselves.
My name is Dick Green from the Department of Higher Education and Training. My portfolio is acting chief director for teaching and learning development. And one of our responsibilities is to support the initial teacher education system.
Honorable Chairperson, good morning. Good morning to the honorable members. My name is Craig Kitsia. I'm responsible for initial teacher education at the Department of Basic Education.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. I think we felt it is important that we need to provide a context to the briefing on the research report as the two departments, that the establishment of the initial teacher education research project was actually prompted by the concern about the quality of education outcomes in South Africa and the important role that teacher quality plays in relation to learner outcomes. And this is actually the output for of the integrated strategy framework for teacher education and development that was begun. So the aim of the study is actually to inform the departments of higher education, the Department of Basic Education, as well as the higher education institution, of the state of the initial teacher education and the early teaching experience of the newly qualified teachers.
Therefore, it is important that it should be understood that the initial education research project is a partnership between the Department of Higher Education and Training, the Department of Basic Education, the Education Deans Forum, as well as HET. So I'm going to ask Dr. Green to make the presentation, which will be followed by a presentation from Dr. Taylor. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Kojana. As Mr. Kojana has indicated, what we'd like to do is really present the context in which the current research project on issues of education can be understood. It's also important to run through the initial teacher education system as it exists at present, both in relation to where we've come from historically, as well as the kind of initiatives that we are putting in place to strengthen teacher education in the country. Members will be aware of the integrated strategic planning framework, which really does provide a kind of guiding framework for our work around teacher education. A collaborative partnership strongly between the Department of Basic Education, the Department of Higher Education and Training, and a range of education stakeholders in the South African system. The DOGC particularly is responsible for leading Output 4 of the Integrated Strategic Plan Framework, which talks to the need to develop an expanded and accessible full teacher education system. The presentation that I'm going to do today is grounded within this output. The research that Dr. Taylor will also present on today is grounded within this output, within the framework. Just to remind members of the formal teacher education landscape, teacher education is a national competence funded by national governments regulated through the DAGT. Teacher education is offered by accredited higher education institutions. So any institution has to be accredited as a higher education institution and accredited to offer the teacher education qualifications. I will talk to the quality assurance regime that's in place in order to regulate it a little later. Teaching is a graduate career at present. Only pathway into becoming a teacher is either through a four-year Bachelor of Education degree or through an undergraduate degree plus a postgraduate certificate in education. For schooling, teachers can specialize to teach in different phases, the foundation phase, the intermediate phase, the senior phase, and the FET. And within those phases, they can choose to specialize to teach certain subjects. At present, 23 universities offer initial teacher education across the country. The two new universities, University of Mpumalanga and South Florida University, are newly established universities, and they already have teacher education programs in place. The only university that does not offer teacher education at present is two universities, the City University of Technology and VAR University of Technology. However, VAR University of Technology is coming on board quite soon. We're also noting an increasing involvement in private higher education institutions becoming involved in teacher education and offering teacher education programs. A key focus of our work over the past few years and as we move forward has to be the issue of quality. We have to foreground quality as being at the heart of teacher education development. That has become very clear over the last few years. The quality at the heart of all our efforts to strengthen, improve, expand initial teacher education. We understand in the complexity of this issue relating to quality that it's not a simple matter and that there are multiple dimensions that interact and intersect to impact on quality. Three important ones stand out. The issue of size, the size of teacher education, size of the system so that it reduces the number of teachers that the country needs is a key quality issue. Too big, too small, both have implications for quality. The issue of teacher education shape. So given that we have a specific size of the system, is the shape appropriate? Are we producing the kind of teachers the system needs? So, for example, it's no use producing 20,000 FET teachers. We really need 20,000 foundation phase teachers. So to get the shape right is becoming more and more important as we grow towards a point where size becomes something that is meeting expectations, including the kind of subject specializations that our graduates are able to teach. And then there's the issue of substance, the substance of teacher education. What's happening inside of teacher education in order to provide the kinds of teachers we need? And quality is at the heart of substance. What about the programs provide the kind of teachers we need? And the research project being led by Dr. Nick Taylor is firmly grounded within the issue of substance, understanding the substance of teacher education in order to strengthen our ability to support teacher education towards improved quality. So some questions become quite important then around size, shape, and substance. What's the appropriate size? How should we develop an appropriate shape? And how do we strengthen and support the delivery of initial teacher education? So we have to hold these three in our hands simultaneously. And in the past, I think we've been having some slippage, where we've had a big focus on size. You know, the crisis around teacher supply, for example, has encouraged government, state, the departments to focus on expansion in teacher education in order to produce more teachers for the system. As we go forward, increasingly, it has to be about, yes, this is the size, but what about capability and quality? We also understand that this has to be a partnership. It can't be about the department, talking about the department of higher education training or the department of basic education training. It has to be a partnership between the departments involved, including the provincial departments, the universities, the schools, and the profession itself. All have to work together to drive towards the issue of quality. Right, so the development of partnerships. And the National Teacher Education and Development Committee, emerging out of the Integrated Strategic Plan framework, is one such forum through which these partnerships are strongly being driven. I want to focus just quickly on size, and just to give members an indication of where we are in relation to the size issue. So over the last few years, we have implemented a number of strategies to increase the size of teacher education. So for example, we've worked with universities to increase enrollments through the enrollment planning process that the Department of Higher Education and Training engages with in terms of the universities. That has led to increased enrollments. We've also supported universities around dedicated funding for infrastructure at the universities, teacher education infrastructure. Over the last two cycles, we've allocated $451 million and $662 million, specifically to teacher education infrastructure at the institutions. So if you visit many of our institutions, you'll see new lecture halls, new teaching rooms, new facilities for teacher education at the institutions. We've moved, the third strategy is establishing new teacher education campuses. This strategy is unfolding as we need expand capacity beyond what we have at present. I can give you a couple of examples just now in another slide. I'll point to specific examples of these new campuses. The reuse of the teacher education colleges is part of the strategy, part of the third strategy. Right? So to reuse campuses that are viable for teacher education as part of the expansion of teacher education. But these would be university campuses offering university programs within the confines of laws and regulations we have in country at present. A Clinton Kunza Lushaka bursary scheme. In 2013, $890 million has been allocated to support 14,500 students. And an implementation of a dedicated program that focuses on foundation phase, strengthening the foundation base in teacher education in order to produce more capable teachers for that particular phase. But then we've dedicated $141 million over the last 3 years to grow foundation phase teacher education. So these strategies that have been implemented to grow the size and shape of teacher education. I'll indicate what campus scenario was. So the Siyabuswa Teacher Education Campus attached to the University of Mpumalanga is a former Ndebele College of Education. It has now been reused for teacher education in Mpumalanga. In the Northern Cape, Swartlyke University has newly been established, a central campus in Kimberley. It's currently offering a BA in senior phase and SET, and will next year also be offering a BA in intermediate phase, and thereafter introduce foundation phase. In the Eastern Cape, we are supporting Nelson Mandela Metropolitan University to grow teacher education on the Mission Vale campus. of that university and foundation phase will be a strong feature of that project. In KwaZulu-Natal, we are working with the Durham University of Technology to develop a precinct in the Imbali area of Pietermaritzburg, the Imbali Education Precinct, which is really a novel mechanism for delivering education, a new mechanism, an integrated mechanism of a number of institutions collaborating in one locality to deliver a chain of education right from early childhood education right up through to PhD studies. Teacher education is growing as part of that Imbali Education Precinct as well. In Gauteng, we are supporting Vaal University of Technology to introduce teacher education, specifically linked to the technical subjects, technical and vocational education and training subjects. And then we also supported University of Limpopo, Walter Sisulu University, Central University of Technology, Old University, UCT, TUT, and the University of the Western Cape to all newly developed foundation-based programs and to start to begin to offer those. Those have been part of the Symphony Foundation-based teacher education program. So where we had 13 universities offering foundation phase in 2009, we're now at the point where there are 21 universities involved in foundation phase teacher education. What is this having? What impact is it having, all of these initiatives? I've just provided you with some figures that you can have a look at, showing the growth that happened since 2008 and projecting up to 2019. If you see the color coding there, green indicates those are audited figures. The orange indicates that these are figures that have come through but we're still in the process of auditing them. And the black figures indicate the projections that have been tied down in a ministerial enrollment plan for universities. So you can see headcount enrollments have increased in teacher education from 35,000 in 2008 to reach 135,000 by 2019. So an increase of 100,000 over 10 years. If we look at the similar picture in terms of graduates, you'll see how it's translating into graduations as well. Where in 2008, we had just less than 6,000 new teachers. By 2019, we have 23,500 new teachers graduating from our country's universities. Right? So also quite massive growth, 131% between 2008 and 2030. AGT has been involved in developing a supply-demand model because we have to get our hands much more tightly on this issue of teacher supply and demand in order to steer the system appropriately. So we've developed what we call a multivariate cumulative predictive supply-demand model. Now, those seem like convoluted words, but they really do mean what the model does. It's multivariate in the sense that it considers the whole range of variables. Right? It's predictive in the sense that it looks at where we are now and tries to predict to the future. And it's cumulative in the sense that it combines figures 4 years between where we are now and where we are going to be in the future to give us a picture of a point in the future. I've indicated, I'm not going to go through this in too much detail, it's going to take too much time, but these are the kind of variables that one would need to take into account in terms of planning for teacher supply and demand. And then a simple kind of calculation of here's the demand, here's the supply, demand minus supply gives you the supply-demand gap. you'll note firstly that the red one are out here. If I go back, you'll see the red ones are issues like curriculum expansion, quality enhancement, and in demand. They are issues that you can't get a hand on tightly, and probably are issues that you can't address directly through initial teacher education. So, for example, if you have unqualified teachers in the system, or underqualified, it's not about getting rid of those teachers, it's about strategies to ensure that they become qualified. That should be a continuing professional development process, rather than an initial teacher education process, or a combination of both, if systems allow that to happen. So the real ones are ones that you can't get a complete hold on. When you populate the model, it comes to something like that, utilizing supply and demand. That by 2020, if the model were such, it would mean that you're actually going to be in excess in terms of the number of teachers we need to a cumulative total of 135,000. So we're reaching a point by 2020 where the teacher supply demand gap has been completely minimized, where the kind of growth that we're seeing in the system is going to be matching what we need for the system. Now, I want to just highlight a certain point. Those three, the yellow ones, are highly unpredictable. That figure of 10,910 are the unemployed teachers, the teachers in the unemployed database. Right? So we projected from the unemployed database. Now, one doesn't know the extent to which that pool would last. The second one, the big one, is even more important, 113,830. What our research has shown is that there are a high number of teachers coming into the system as late joiners or as returning teachers. So they leave the system, go out of the system, they're not in PASAL for a number of years. Or they've never been in PASAL before, and then they come into the system as teachers about age 30 and over, late joiners or returning joiners. Now, there's a number of reasons for that, I think. For example, a graduate might choose not to teach in the country directly after graduating. Teach somewhere else and then come back once a study permit or something like that has expired and come and join the teaching profession. A graduate might choose to follow another career after graduation and then come back into teaching when the economy shrinks, as is the case across the world at present. It's a huge number of people coming back every year, about 13,000, coming back from other sources every year. In fact, more teachers are coming in as late joiners than are coming in as new graduates. And that's been the real savior, I think, for the country over the last few years. Because the universities haven't been producing enough teachers, but we haven't really hit a train smash because of this pool of late joiners. Now, it's something unpredictable as well. We can't say, there's no way of us knowing, is this pool going to continue through the future? Is it such substance that will carry us through to 2020? Right? It's something completely unpredictable. Although we want to now try and engage on further research, try and understand that much more strongly, what's happening there. Then there's the 17,500. Those are foreign immigrants. Right? So people coming in from out of the country who have qualifications and who want to teach in country. So cumulative total from 2012 to 2020 would indicate that about 70,500 foreign teachers would want to teach in country. That gives us, if we take those out now, if we take those completely unpredictable supply size variables out, you see the picture alters quite dramatically, where we start to get a balance between what the country is producing for itself and what the need is. Right? The balance is more or less there. It's only an accumulated negative total of 6,000 by 2012, so minus 829 per year, which these other sources would easily supply as a kind of comfort zone in terms of that. So we're reaching a point in 2020 where supply and demand, our projections are showing supply and demand will meet the needs of the system. But the questions really now are, okay, that's where we are. The size right, or the size is going to be right, is the shape right? Right? So by 2020, the size of the system will be appropriate. The system will be producing sufficient numbers of new teachers, according to this model. And I must say that this kind of work is very messy. It's based on data that comes from a number of sources that can have flaws in it. It's also based on a lot of assumptions. You know, you make assumptions about certain variables and you calculate on the base of assumptions. So rather than the fixation with numbers, I think what the planning, what the model is useful for is giving us trends, showing us patterns around how we can inform our planning. Right? So likely that by 2020, that we probably will not have an absolute shortage of teachers. But if we're not proactive, we could still have a relative shortage. We could have a relative shortage of foundation-based teachers with respect to SAT teachers. Or we could have a relative shortage of math teachers with respect to life orientation teachers. Or we could have a relative shortage of teachers who are willing to teach in an urban environment with respect to teachers willing to teach in a rural environment. So we have to be proactive around the shaping of the system as we go forward. And that really has to be a key feature of the work. So we need to focus on the shape, getting the proportions right, getting the subject specializations right. We have to focus on teachers other than school teachers. So teachers for the TV system, teachers for the community college system, teaching at universities is something we also have to start thinking about in our bigger thinking of teacher education. We've completely ignored the development of specialist teachers, teachers for the deaf, teachers for the blind, teachers for the intellectually impaired. We have to grow a system to produce those kind of teachers. This has to come into planning over the next few years. Right. And then there are persistent questions about quality. We know that universities tend to work in isolation of each other. It's something we have to address. We know, and Dr. Taylor's research is going to show that there's a high degree of divergence in teacher education curricula, in terms of selections, in terms of time allocation, in terms of depth, in terms of breadth. We have to address this. We know that there's a theory-practice divide, that there may be an over-focus on theory and not enough translation into concrete practice in teacher education. We want to understand better the ability of newly qualified teachers to work at the intersections between the disciplinary content knowledge, the maths that they learn, and curriculum maths, right? The maths in the school curriculum, and to be able to make that translation. Right? These are the things that start the work and the research is starting to highlight as things we have to focus on over the next few years. Now, the work has started. This focus on quality has started. We have a quality assurance regime in the country. Right? Working right from the NQF right down to the minimum requirements on teacher education qualifications, we've introduced a policy. The research that Dr. Taylor will present will be a research on qualifications and programs that are being offered in terms of a previous policy, the norms and standards for educators, which have been in place since 2000. The norms and standards for educators was an outcomes-based policy that provided no real guidance around the content of teacher education programs, like many of our outcomes-based curriculum approaches. And it gave the leeway for institutions to kind of package programs in a very flexible way, as long as they could point to the outcomes that are being achieved through those programs. And that's the situation we have at present. The minimum requirement for teacher education qualifications has much more direction in terms of teacher education qualifications. And then we're also thinking that there might be a next step around this issue of standard setting, that we might want to think about working with knowledge and practice standards. So putting in place, for example, what does it mean to be a maths teacher in terms of the knowledge that maths teacher must have and the competences in terms of teaching practice? And have that as an extra guideline in the system for bringing curriculum convergence. But I think the research also clearly we have to work the field in order to do that. And that is already starting to happen. Okay, so here's the policy and minimum requirements. I think it's important to foreground this because it highlights that we are in change, in a system of change. There's transition happening. We're moving from one policy environment into another policy environment, which is a different place. So the policy and minimum requirements foreground knowledge and practice. It expects that new teachers will know their disciplines. They'll know the school curriculum as it relates to their disciplines, and they'll be able to teach the curriculum. That's the expectation. It expects that the new teachers will be ICT literate, able to integrate ICTs into teaching and learning, that they will be multilingual, and that they will be able to implement inclusive pedagogies. These are expectations of the new policy. And we have to drive the system towards us as we work with the universities. Right, so the work has started. We've qualitatively strengthened teacher education through the foundation phase program. We've developed this new qualifications policy. It's been implemented. We've implemented research projects into teaching schools and professional practice schools because we also have a sense that that's a key area for improvement, that teacher practice component of teacher education programs. And we are supporting the longitudinal research study to investigate the ability of newly qualified teachers to make the transition from teacher education students to teacher. And this is the research study that will be shared with you today. So I wanted to foreground that this study is located centrally within the work of improving the quality of teacher education. And it's highlighting issues that we have to address. Okay, so I think that these points just drive that home, that the project must be understood within the broader context of change and strengthening of initial teacher education. That it's a partnership, and Ms. Kojana did indicate this. That the DHET is a financial contributor to the project and is supporting it strongly, because it's a key project for the nation. Right? The intention of this project is always to understand what qualitative issues are and how they can be addressed. And research is already informing processes of improvement as we go along. In terms of the last slide, honorable members, is really just to give you an indication of what we see as key priorities from 2015 to 2020. And we are shaping a program which we are calling the Teaching and Learning Development Capacity Improvement Program, which has a focus on qualitative strengthening of teacher education. So the things that we'd like to be doing through this program is the development of academic learning communities. So getting universities to work together so that math educators across the system to develop a math teacher education community that starts to interrogate each other's curricula and processes. We'd like to promote this idea of the development of knowledge and practice standards and actually develop them over these next 5 years in collaboration with the field. We'd like to support ongoing research into the iterative relationship between what's happening in schools, in classrooms, and what's happening in teacher education so that they can mutually inform one another. We'd like to have a focus on languages in teaching and learning to ensure that we produce foundation-based teachers who are competent to address the issue of language in a diverse context in which South African, across the South African classrooms exist. We want to start thinking about how do we localize pedagogies? So how do we develop theories, epistemological theories and pedagogy that are relevant to the South African context? That is to support research and collaborative work in that, so that we start to get relevant interpretations of what appears to be good international practices which can possibly make a better impact in country. And we'd like to promote the growth of new teacher educators. You will know that this is high on the Department of Higher Education and Training's agenda, the transformation agenda within higher education, and the growth of academics that are more reflective of the context of South Africa, who understand the context in terms of diversity, and who are able to be responsive to that. And this will also be within the teacher education context as well. But thank you.
Thanks so much, Dr. Grimm. Honourable members, let us not interact with that one. Let us get into Dr. Taylor's report, and then we'll take them together, please. Over to you.
DJ and members of the two departments, colleagues. I think Whitney has placed the project very nicely in context in a third leg of this triangle. It's about substance, it's about quality. Terribly important. I think the country's biggest problem is about the quality of our school system, and I have to show that initial teacher education is a key node in the school system. It's part of the system of schooling, even though we don't normally think of it as such. In fact, you look at the public debates on schooling, Chair, everyone gets blamed for poor quality, from the minister to the department, to the teachers, to the parents, to the curriculum, to the policy, to the unions. No one ever mentions the universities. But colleagues, what goes on behind closed doors every day depends on teacher quality. If there's a minimum system of management in place in the school, and there are many such schools across the country, if there are minimum resources in our schools, and by and large our schools are now well-resourced, if those two things are basically in place, what the children learn depends on what the teacher knows. And so initial teacher education is absolutely key in developing that capacity. We haven't yet found an in-service training model that develops teacher capacity adequately. It has an impact effect. We're hoping and praying for Godwin's cause this project. We have high hopes for it, but until it demonstrates our impact, we will wait and hope that it doesn't go the way of so many other similar projects. But whether it works or not, colleagues, initial teacher education is the long-term sustainable route to building professional expertise among our teachers. And I don't think our universities fully take that into account. If you look at that slide I've got up there, in order to understand what to put into initial teacher education programs, you've got to look back at the learners coming out of the school system. What knowledge and skills are they bringing to these programs, first of all? And then secondly, you've got to look at where they're going as newly qualified teachers. What are they going to have to do in our schools? And only by taking account of those two bracketing sets of conditions can we really understand what we've got to be doing in initial teacher education. And I don't believe our universities are doing that across the board anyway.
So first of all, looking at graduates coming out of schools, what do they bring to their initial teacher education programs? What this slide shows, colleagues, is some extracts from the Ministerial Task Team on the National Senior Certificate that we put in a few months ago. One of the most important chapters, in fact, one of the most important statements, Chair, about schooling in South Africa that has been made in quite a long time, is made in the chapter in this report on English First Traditional Language. They point out that 90% of our learners are schooled in English. It is a lot of 90% of learners.
Excuse me, Doctor. You know, Doctor, we as members want to inform on the presentation so that you can even just have known where was this presentation from. Or it's just the three edits left, okay? We just want to know a little bit about that. It's fine.
It's just a couple of slides. Sorry about that. I thought it was important. So the Ministerial Task Team on the National Senior Certificate analyzed English First Traditional Language in quite some detail through the exam questions in the MIFIC papers. They got three international agencies, in fact, to do this for them, including Cambridge examinations, the New South Wales Border Studies, and I forget the third one now. But collectively, both the Scottish Qualifications Authority, thank you, Mr. Murray, that's right, another real high quality quality assurance body in the world. And they came to this collective conclusion that the ESAL NSE exam questions are heavily weighted towards lower order skills such as literal comprehension and grammar translation tasks. There's not sufficient opportunity to explain and analyze the content, purpose, and audience of text. Interestingly, in paper 2, which is the literature paper, learners can get away without writing an essay at all. Now, I don't know how you respond to complex literature across the world in multiple choice and short answers. It's just, quite no analysis, basically. And the grammatical exercises themselves reject a brilliant practice approach. So we are not really, coming out of school, are these kids being equipped really for university study of any kind? Let alone the study required to go into schools to teach kids through the medium of English. The recommendations of the task group are quite interesting. I won't go into them in some detail. But in fact, one of them is to raise the pass requirements for bachelors in ESAL. So if you want to do a bachelor's degree, you should get a 50% pass in ESAL. Now, interestingly, they actually won't change the number of kids qualifying for bachelor's degree by more than 0.5% or so. So maybe that's even too low, because we know that lots of our kids drop out, and this is probably one of the biggest problems. And then, of course, they recommend raising the cognitive demands of the NSE exams by putting in longer tests as comprehension exercises, etc. Now, that's obviously a lesson that can be taken into higher education, too. If we're schooling our kids to go out into schools and teach in English, we should be teaching these higher-level cognitive skills so that they can explain complicated concepts to their kids in whatever subject they'll be teaching, history, maths, science. Looking at the other side, where the newly qualified teachers go to, what they'll be required to do in their schools. Now, colleague, I want to mention that this study is focusing on the intermediate phase. Whitney pointed out a big DHIS project on the foundation phase over the last 3 or 4 years. So we decided we would leave that and look at the intermediate phase, which in fact includes most of the rest of the primary school as well. Most universities don't have a specialist for intermediate phase. They cover intermediate and senior phases. So it's all primary school teachers, other than foundation phase teachers. Now, what we see in our schools is low levels of English proficiency among both teachers and learners. I think the most effective, the minimum requirement for teacher education qualifications is mandating English now as a very important subject to study in the initial teacher education program. Very important step. The DBE has brought this policy of the CAS policy brings in English as an additional language from grade 1. Terribly important move in my view. to address this problem. Colleagues, maybe the biggest problem the whole country faces is our teachers don't know how to teach adequately. And anything else follows on there. Now again, Mr. Mwele is at the forefront, and Mr. Ugojana, in trying to address this issue by working with provinces to develop reading strategies and reading programs, and I think they're making a lot of progress over the last couple of years. But colleagues, half our grade 5 kids can not read adequately. They've got to 5 years of primary schools and they're still not reading well enough. Many of them not at all. Our teachers can't teach reading. Huge problem. Now what that means, of course, is our initial teacher educators coming out of your universities doesn't be able to teach reading all the way through the primary school. All the way through the primary school, they're going to encounter kids who have reading problems and must know how to diagnose them and must know how to remediate them. And the same for mathematics. Exactly the same applied there too. Low levels of subject knowledge among teachers is well known. But here's one number 5, colleagues, that we don't adequately take account of. Most schools, when they recruit teachers, don't look for subject-specific teachers. In the primary schools, this is. Any teacher who has a qualification is deemed to be adequate to teach anything. The consequence of that is that most teachers, at some or other stage in their careers, have to teach math, they'll have to teach English and subjects. And I don't think our universities are really looking at that. Okay, I'm not going to belabor the point about the importance of ITE, but just to mention the purposes of this project, which has touched on them already, it's to generate information to inform the debate about the quality of initial teacher education. In other words, what knowledge and skills do teachers need in order to act professionally? We've already mentioned its collaborative nature. Research questions, I'm not going to really go into these in much detail, but looking first of all, in fact, I think I'd rather just deal with the components of the project, because the aims will come out of that. The first component was to look at the content of the initial teaching education program at 5 universities. And this is for the intermediate phase. Teachers specialize in the intermediate phase, as I said, and that's what I'm going to be spending the rest of my talk presenting. We will follow this up with case studies of newly qualified teachers from these 5 institutions as they go into the first 2 years of their teaching careers. How do they feel about their initial teacher education? Did it equip them adequately? How are they coping? How have their ideals about teaching changed? We're also doing a survey of all final year B.Ed. students. We started that last year, and then tracking them into the workplace for 2 years as well. So it's similar to number 2, but it's across a broader scale and a more superficial level. And all the way through, we are disseminating these results, and as Woody has mentioned, it's already generated a lot of interest and stimulated a lot of activity, both in government and among the universities. Okay. We selected these 5 campuses to sample all the institutional parts that make up higher education. So we've got historic advantage, historic disadvantage, urban, rural, distance, contact, all of that. We chose our institutions in order to take a sizable chunk of the system. So collectively, these 5 universities produce half of our teachers every year. That's a big slice of the system. We have already, besides the summary report you have received, Chair, we have 3 other reports, one on maths, the maths contents of the curricula that we study, one on English, and one on teaching practice, the instruments used in teaching practice on these 5 universities. These reports are available on the JET website. Okay, let's get into the nitty-gritty of some of the stuff now. Looking at maths courses for intermediate phase teachers who are specializing as maths teachers across 5 institutions A to E. First of all, in terms of numbers, are we producing enough maths teachers for the country? The numbers are quite low. They range from a low of 10% in the 4th year at one institution up to 33% in institution B. Is it enough? What he spoke about, shape? Very, very important question. Should we be putting quotas on these numbers? should we be encouraging more learners to take maths and specialization? One of the biggest things about this slide, one of the most noteworthy things is about the entrance requirements required across the five campuses. You'll see on campus C, for example, you can get a 30% pass in maths literacy and become a math teacher. You have to question whether that's good or not. At institution B, on the other hand, you need a 50% pass in maths if you want to specialize as a maths teacher. Now, you see what Ricky means when he says the universities are talking to each other. Look at these huge discrepancies across the field. And then also the last column, the proportion of the B.Ed. degree taken up with maths courses, methodology courses, content courses, range from a low of 13% at one institution to a high of 25% on another. Colleagues, I want to say even 25%. Is that enough? Do you really want to be a clean-up math teacher who lives in subject? Is 25% of a course enough? But now the scary part is those teachers who are not specializing in that as math teachers in the intermediate phase. Remember, at some other stage, they're going to have to go and teach maths. Are they going to stand in front of the class with mouth full of teeth, or are they going to be able to swim in that environment and really get their kids excited about numeracy and mathematics? But if you look at the proportion of the B.Ed. degree taken up by these courses, it's quite divisive. From 2.5% on one of the programs to 13% on another. Clearly, hopelessly inadequate. These guys are going to be chucked into the classroom to teach math, and no wonder they're scared of math when they get to schools. Now, there's a question here. Now, this is actually a policy question. Should all primary school teachers be equipped to teach mathematics? I think, you know, you can make a very strong case for that. And I would argue that case. And even those who are specializing, shouldn't they spend more time on their specialization? Now, I'm not going to go into the details of the content of these courses, but we looked at that, and we looked at the quality as well in terms of the cognitive demands placed on students through their subject tone in mathematics. And there too, we found a huge range, colleagues, in terms of content and quality of these courses. Just to emphasize the point that we need to get together, we need these math educators to get together to talk to each other about their standards and start collaborating. Turning to English courses for intermediate phase teachers specializing in English, again, you'll see this huge range. Now, we've got three kinds of offerings in the BS programs. Most universities offer some or other kind of academic literacy. They do recognize the fact that students coming out of school have low English skills and writing skills in general, and so they provide them with some academic literacy to try and address that problem. I want to say, is this enough? You know, the smallest amount will organization C doesn't offer any academic literacy per se, but it builds up into its English modules. But then at institution D, we've got two semesters of academic literacy. Is two semesters enough to get them to a higher level of academic reading and writing? And then a lot of variation also in terms of English subject knowledge and in terms of school and pedagogic knowledge. But here's the really scary part. Those teachers not specializing as English teachers, this is the English they get in their B.Ed. degrees. Again, we see some academic literacy on four of the five campuses. But you go to the second row, subject knowledge English. No subject knowledge English is provided on three of the campuses for these guys. Coming out of school with very low English proficiency skills, having to go into schools to teach English, and some of them having to be English teachers. So that's the really scary thing for me, and you know, my current campaign is to focus on that issue and to say we really need to think very carefully about everyone doing large chunks of English. And colleagues, this is not about English as a subject. This is about the language of learning and teaching. And make the same case for whatever language you adopt. In terms of the proportion of the B.Ed. taken up by English courses, the top row is for those specializing to be English teachers. between 50% of their programs and a third of their programs. Is that enough? And then again, for those who are not specializing in English, to write with little English is given to them. Lots of questions coming out of here. I'll put a little quote from the minimum requirements for each education qualification at the bottom, which he mentioned that this is the new policy now regulating curricula. The curricula we studied were prior to this, they're under the old system, so everyone's in transition now. But Mr. Dick advocates quite a bit about English as traditional language, as you can see from that brief quote. But we want to say that shouldn't all primary school teachers be given a lot more English, be highly, highly proficient in English when they go into schools? Not much attention is given to children's literature on these courses, so teachers would not be able to advise their learners very well on the source of reading material they should be pursuing. Almost no reading pedagogy is offered to these intermediate phase teachers. Remember, I pointed out earlier that they all, whatever subjects they teach, they are going to have reading problems in their classes, in every class they go into, across the length and breadth of South Africa. The country's biggest problem. We're not catering for it in our initial teacher education program. We're not teaching intermediate phase teachers about the pedagogy, the theory, and practice of reading. Terribly important gap. The same goes for writing. Now, you know, text is a writing curriculum. It's literature-based. It's about reading and writing a variety of genres. Our universities are not teaching these intermediate phase teachers how to teach writing. Okay. I just want to conclude here by saying, pointing out again the huge variation across these five institutions in terms of the quality and the context of the programs. We saw some excellent practices, certainly, that could be shared across the board, but we don't think any of the institutions we study is fully meeting the requirements of the school system, especially in terms of English, reading, and writing pedagogies. We are advocating a very serious discussion among teacher educators. Now, Ricky mentioned the road policy, and I think we've done a remarkable job in addressing the size issue. It's incredible, actually. I mean, 5 years ago, there was a huge panic across the country that we were going to run out of teachers. In that period, we have got to the point now where we're going to have excess teachers in the future. Astonishing achievement, actually. But now the quality, back to the quality. Now, the problem with policy is it's terribly important, but it can't actually drive policy. The problem is that you can make all sorts of specifications with policy. The teacher educators can appear to be complying, and they can carry on doing what they like. You've got to extract the feed about the question of quality. You have to put it in their court and stimulate the debate about quality right there. And I'm pleased to say that, in fact, it's starting to happen. Last week, Woody and I were both at a conference at WITS, which drew a wide concentration from across the country. And we gave a keynote speech there about this project, in fact. And then our maths researcher did the maths part, and our English person did the English part. And so there was quite wide input from this project at that conference. And interestingly, straight after the maths input, a bunch of people in the audience got together, math educators across the country, and said, we've got to start meeting. We've got to start talking about these things, and we've got to get on with sharing our best practices. So very encouraging. I think it's a project from Simon's Cup. And that is my story, Chair. And thank you for your attention.
Thank you very much to both our presenters for their good stories. I'm not saying that it's a story to tell, but they were good stories for us to listen to. I think what Dr. Green said, what the learner learns depends on what the teachers know. Mm-hmm. And I want to further say what the teachers teach down there, and the knowledge they impact to our learners depends on what the lecturers that have taught them in the institutions know. Because in all what you are saying here, for me, the fundamental question is, Yes, the universities want to change, they want to change the program, but are we ready when it comes to human resources, even the lecturers, to do what you are expecting them to do? Can they teach us to read? Can they teach us to go to those classrooms and teach learners to write, read, comprehend, and whatever? I think it was quite a very interesting presentation that we've got. And honorable members, can we interact with the two presentations? Okay, I will. Let me note the hands. You are going to assist me, my co-chair, with the names of the honorable members from higher education, because I know there are things that I won't be able to do. Okay, I will start with Professor Bozu, followed by Honorable Professor Bozu. You put them on, okay? Okay. Honorable Bozoli, followed by Honorable Kasim, followed by Honorable Mpunu, followed by Honorable Basson. Should I keep them all at once? Can I stop there for now? Can we have those four? We interact, then we get another one to make it.
Thank you very much, Chair. Thank you for the presentation. First point is, it is very shocking to me that after 20 years, our government is now planning, but only planning, to expect teachers to know their disciplines and be able to convey the content to their pupils. I was quite amazed that this hasn't been the mission from the beginning, and that this is now suddenly paraded as a new idea that the teachers should know their discipline. One wonders what on earth has been going on for the last 20 years. So I found the department's contribution very offensive. I think they know that they have some problems to deal with and have therefore preempted Dr. Taylor's very critical presentation with a whole lot of defenses about how wonderful everything is and what marvelous things they have planned. And the question does arise, as I say, well, what on earth has been going on for the last 20 years? But my second point is, when it comes to Dr. Taylor's presentation, I do think he has softened the content of what is actually in the report. Again, perhaps because the department is here listening, ready to jump on every word. Because if you look at the report itself, on page 8, what seems to be going on in these teacher education colleges, ex-colleges, now university departments, is far beyond what he presented. For example, he says on page 8, teaching practice, most supervisors are not subject specialists. In at least two institutions, it's possible for students to pass teaching practice despite performing poorly in a classroom or even without being assessed on their classroom expertise. ITE programs have low entrance requirements in comparison with most other disciplines. Students are accepted without any reference as to what motivates them to become teachers. And this is something we've heard from head teachers in actual schools who said they get students coming on teaching prac who really don't really want to become a teacher other than to get the Bunza Lushaka bursary. And probably never will become teachers. So that point needs to be addressed. Teacher educators have very low expectations of the academic quality of students, and there is very little effort, and I think that has come through, to transform these poor quality entrants into good quality reflective practitioners. In some institutions, the focus appears to be on quantity more than quality. Can I say that I think in this respect, the institutions are following the lead of the government department which manages the situation, because the focus there too has been on quantity. Quantity, quantity, quantity. You see it in higher education generally. We want more, more, more people, and we don't actually care what goes on in the classroom. and even the issue of, well, how many parts, is constantly lamented, but we don't see any serious effort to address it. So my overall point here, is that this is a far more serious and deep-rooted issue than perhaps came across from the two presentations. Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson. I want to speak a little bit about the Funza Sucker Bursary, because I think there are some issues there, and I want to highlight it. The first one, as was raised by Prof, was with regards to students who undergo teacher training or teacher education because they want a profession and they cannot get funding. They cannot get funding in the profession of their choice because of the shortages within NASFAS itself. So they will, in order to get the Funza Lusaka bursary and to have something to study, they decide, well, let me become a teacher because it's better than nothing. This is a very serious issue. I just would like to hear what is the approach of the departments with regards to that in particular? And has there any research been done into those students who receive funding with the Funza Lusaka bursary and their progress, or are we looking to undergo any research, I've suggested, and their progress and where they go on to teach and so forth. But the second point in more critically is that there's a large amount of resources that are invested into these students, but there's no clear follow-up in terms of their placement. Now, there are a number of students that receive the bursary. It's been 3 to 5 years since they graduated. They have now moved on and they've found a teaching post by one of the more affluent schools, perhaps in another province as well, and they've never been placed. Now, we've got teacher shortages in your schools, more particularly in the rural areas, where there's a very low supply of teachers, but students that we've invested in have just been let off the hook and not been made to pay their debt back to society. Now, I just want to see whether or not that has been picked up, what is the extent of that problem, and how is that going to be addressed.
Thank you, Chair. Let me first thank the presentation, and I believe that the initial teacher education research project was a good idea, and it really reflects what is happening in our education system. On your page 6, on the findings about teacher education, what you have said there about the theory practice divide, it is true, but I think we really need to look at the impact of distance learning programs offered by universities, because you will find that there are mostly challenges are experienced with those students that are in distance learning programs. So it's because I don't know where the research was done in terms of campuses, because we would have now realized that all these really offer the distance or it's a full-time one. Yeah, that is the part that I think is of the greatest concern. I also support your recommendations, Dr. Green, of training teachers in English for academic purposes, especially where English is not home language. Because in most schools, English is the language of learning and teaching, you're not. So we really need to ensure that we do equip our teachers in order for them to be able to teach this subjects in the language of learning and teaching, because what happens is that they will teach your mathematics, your history, your physical science using code switching, that's what it is called. They will teach it in your English and then switch to the home language. Thank you. We need to look at that.
Honorable
Baswan.
Thank
you, Jonathan. Thank you, Presenter. Indeed, this is a session that we need. Listening to the two presentations, I have noted that just to join what the chairperson has said, furthermore, it goes deeper than the feeders or the well or the school that feeds the system with educators to be drying up, more especially on math and science. I find that the whole problem lies in recruitment strategy when recruiting these teachers. According to the steps that Dr. Taylor has shown, number of educators taking a career as their profession, but few are interested in it. And you will notice that even at our school level, few learners are taking it. Then at the end, those few learners are regarded as those or senior learners. They take better careers like being doctors and lawyers and what. And the system of education, those that join education are those 12% and 13% that they approach from there. Now my question is that, what, according to your research, what strategy can you advise the system to use when recruiting teachers to get real educators for the subject or for the purpose, for the needs, as we said once that the profile of the teacher should suit the system, the needs of the school. So outside the crowd is on net English. And what can you advise to your rather than come to the former colleagues? Thank you.
Thank you. I just wanted to put that back also that I can come today. We have got the number of members. I see one honorable member here at me as the third person because if he was let out mistaken, can I take you honorable member then? I'll let him respond, then I'll come to another one.
Thank you, Chairperson. We all have somewhere to start. And obviously, the department also had somewhere to start. And we learn from history. In the history, we learn from the past so that we're able to determine the future. And I think the department is correct to suggest that there have been lessons that have been learned in the past 20 years. And therefore, going forward, there are issues that need to be taken on. And obviously with regard to the Funza Shaka bursary, I think the department is doing well to give learners bursaries. But also, that's one thing that needs to be said here, is that those people that are actually at institutions who identify these learners must do their work properly so that they select the right people for these courses. Not just to dish out this money that government provides, to whoever who got started somewhere and change the course of his or his studies. And with that said, I believe that we should embrace what the department and of course what the research is suggesting going forward as a learning curve and believing that we should be able to learn from these two reports or presentations that we got so that we are able as a department to go forward and address the issues that confront us. And I think that would probably be the best way going forward. Thank you.
Thank you so much. And I think it's very important. I'm not sure with the other committee. With basic education, really, I don't think today is the first time that we talk of the issues of quality when it comes to issues of education. You know,
I don't want to register this today. It's for the first time in this case in our education routine. And I believe in both departments. But what you are here for is to say, having recognized, having realized the gaps that we have, the challenges that are there. And for us to be engaging with the research, of course, it's not for the first time. I can assure you, the department will always have engagement with them. We always have an outcry of what is happening. We know these things. The department always comes. So let not be as if today only the first time that Dr. Taylor is here to be in charge of some of these things. So it cannot be, but we're thankful to Dr. Taylor that you have done that research, opening more for more, even more avenues to say how best can we correct the situation, how best can we address the challenges that we're encountering as the education sector. But let me give you the opportunity to go to the presenters so that you can see, you can go to another room, another room.
Well, thank you very much, Honorable Chair. I think, firstly, let me preface the responses. We will all be taking some, I mean, responses to the questions that has been raised. But to say that the insights provided by the report are actually intended to contribute to an informed discussion about the design and the delivery of initial child education curricula and most people to reform their country's schooling system. And I must say that when we premised to say it is important for the department to make an initial contribution before the report is tabled, it was actually not a defensive stance but to provide a context at which we have actually through the NPEPC agreed to undertake this research. It's because of a number of concerns that has been raised, maybe at portfolio committees, to say the debate was more about the competency vis-à-vis the qualification initially. And the debate was also around the opening of colleges vis-à-vis universities. I think members would recall that we've been having some serious debates around this matter. And we kept on saying that we are conducting some research that informs us as to what is actually happening in the initial tertiary education. This is the outcome of the first part within the components that has been outlined to say what is actually happening there. So it's not about us being defensive as government. Yes, indeed. We have also responded to the question when we premised the presentation to say that there has been an issue of moving from, in terms of the standards, as well as the norms, from the initial norms that were there in 2000, and the revised one, Mr. Tech, around what is it that should be the focus, and the president has been able to speak at length on that one. But colleagues will also, including Mr. Gutierrez and Beck, will be able to respond on Miller's question. But let me give over to Dr. Taylor first, and then followed by Dr. Green and as well as Mr. Khalifudia. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. I think I'd like to address mainly Professor Honorable Buzoni's point. The other points are very well taken, colleagues, but I think they're largely supportive of the idea that we should try and recruit more math teachers and teach more English in our classes. And thank you for that support. I think it is a terribly obvious thing that we really must get moving on. And it's an area where policy can make a difference. But getting back to Honorable Buzoni's point, yes, you know, teacher education was long a gap in our discussions. I remember the old Department of Education was a small directorate there on teacher education. It wasn't very active. They did a few stats. But it didn't really do a lot. And it was puzzled me, it frustrated me, in fact, that we as a community, I mean, it's part of the whole absence in the public debate about schooling. It's a gap in the public perception that we need to get to grips with this thing. Of course, the CHE has been there, the Council on Higher Education. They have done, in 2010, they released a very major report on the quality of initial teacher programs. And that report was extremely damning for those of you who read it. And I believe the reason why it took so long to come out, it took something like 2 or 3 years to see the light of day after the search had been completed, was they were finding diplomatic ways of putting this disaster that they saw in the ITE sector. Now again, you can say, why haven't we been doing anything about this? Well, you know, it's a tricky space, because universities are autonomous institutions. At the slightest rattle of a government pen, they will hide behind academic autonomy. And that's why I've been very careful in how we approach this question. I certainly don't think we should go to the press. Now, a lot of our research, which you would have seen, ends up in the press. And you know, the press specialists, they love education stories. And they love brand new stories, the better. I've tried my best to keep this out of the press, because I don't want to spook the ITE sector. I don't want them to feel they're in a corner. Because of this academic autonomy, because of this extreme latitude they have in teaching and researching what they like, what they think best, and it's quite correct, colleagues, to have that autonomy. You can't tell people what to research. Well, you can encourage them, and I think we should incentivize research on all sorts of things. First and foremost, an effective reading theory, an effective reading pedagogy. I've said it a couple of times now, is the country's biggest national need. We should pour money into that research. So what do we do? Yeah, we've got the very tricky beast, the ITE sector, high levels of autonomy, high levels of spookiness, anything concerning government or the press. How do we encourage them? How do we stimulate them to take this thing on board? Well, that's the strategy behind this project. To put this information on the table and say, guys, this is where we are. Is this right? This is where we should be. Where should we be going from here? And I'm very pleased to emphasize again that it's already being picked up. So I think it's the correct strategy. That's not to say we shouldn't do more with policy. I think we could mandate that all teachers should have a course in maths. We should mandate even more English than Mr. Tech is mandating. We can allocate research funds for reading pedagogy and all sorts of things. But at the end of the day, this quality issue has got to be solved by the field itself.
Thank you, Chair. I think I wasn't going to respond to Prof. Zulu because I think she did pull up quite an important issue. The DHEC is in no way being defensive of the research and how it's already on. In fact, we strongly supporting it and were part of the initiation of it. Really, what I attempted to do, as Mr. Pajano was saying, was highlight the fact that we need to think of this research, these findings, and the interventions that follow from it in the context of change in teacher education and change towards improved quality. That's really what we're working towards. So, the DHEC certainly wants to engage as widely as possible, and Nick has indicated the kind of forums that we're having involved in. We're presenting this kind of analysis in pretty much the same way as we presented yesterday, within the context of teacher education change and teacher education development. I think Nick, to some degree, has overplayed the issue of accountability and autonomy in teacher education. We do have some levers at our disposal that enables us to work with universities so that they are more responsive. So it's not just complete autonomy that universities need. I mean, the policy lever is one important lever. So to put policy in place that regulates offerings to a certain extent. But we also have the resource lever, the financial levers as well, where we support programs that are aligned to policy. We also see ourselves as a Department of Higher Education and Training, not merely playing a regulatory role in teacher education, but playing a developmental role, playing a supportive role. And I think this is a change that has occurred over the last few years. This work has really started in 2007, where we had a big focus on what are the issues in teacher education. And there were two main catalysts, or two markers in the field in that period of 2007-2008. So one was a CHE review of teacher education qualifications and a whole range of others. But the other one was the National Policy Framework, the Ministerial Committee on Teacher Education, that was set up, that came up with the National Policy Framework for Teacher Education and Development. that spoke to the issue of more teachers, better teachers. More, better. So the issue of quality and quantity has been at the foreground from 2007 at least. So I take the member comments, where has government been all the time? It's been an evolutionary process. I don't think we can deny or defend it. But certainly since 2007, there's been a strong focus on growing teacher education, both in terms of quality and quantity, utilizing the levers at our disposal.
Thank you. Thank you so much. I know one other issue that has been raised is the whole issue of Funza Lushaga, I'll definitely do that. I'll give it to the Department of Basic Education to what they're saying, because now, we are more focused on what we are doing on initial teacher training, but I know it's come in when it comes to the issues of Funza Lushaga. How do we recruit? Is the bursary, the funding that should be getting necessary outcome of that? So basic education, can you deliver with that response? I know it's going to come up. Then can I hand over to you, Michael, to the Minister of Education?
Right. Let me see how many more would like to make. Is it follow-up questions? Okay. No questions. That's fine. Ms. Killian, Lovemore. Ms. Lovemore. Ms. Mr. Fargals and Ms. Koshoff. Mr. Mguni and then Ms. Mko. Photo. Sorry for that. Thank you very much. In that order. Okay, Mr. Tekan.
Thank you, Chairperson. Chairperson, thank you very much for the responses, because that is one of my questions that, in fact, been answered. But I just wanted to ask, if we look at the departmental presentation, the model that you've developed, and then I just start by saying it is indeed heartening to see that we have improved the numbers in education. And I think that is nothing short of a miracle, but clearly we have a very serious challenge as far as quality is concerned. But I just wanted to know if the model is also informed by Stats South Africa, expansion, the new walls, etc., that are anticipated up to 2020, and migration patterns. Is that in fact, because somehow the shape and the size and everything must also meet the requirements of where those people are. Now, how do you adjust that? How do you factor that into it? Then secondly, the issue of colleges. Part of good education practices creates a balance between theory and practical teaching. Assessment. Is the department considering to bring in some or other policy, or would Dr. Taylor recommend something that we have more regular assessment of students in classroom activities as part of the practical assessment? Because I think if we look at content, yes, certainly, indeed, teachers should know their subjects, but on the other hand, how they communicate their knowledge is another key issue. I remember in my own experience, I had a very good math teacher, and ultimately, I'm not a science math person, but I managed maths, matric. But in the end, the science teacher lost me, because she was so clever. She was a doctor in science, but she was just not a good teacher. So it comes all along, those are sort of practical experiences we've had. How do you assess that practical ability? And then lastly, Chairperson, will we, with this intervention, it's clear that we need to meet certain ADP targets for maths and science. What is the accelerated program that we need to achieve in order to meet the requirements of the NDP? Is this phase one? Has the department developed sort of certain targets and I think also to get buy-in from the higher education institutions to meet those targets? What are you doing as far as that is concerned? Thank you, Chair.
Again, I will now call upon Ms. Lovemore.
Thank you, Chairperson. I'm going to start by linking to my colleague, Honourable Bazzoli, and it's very difficult not to feel extremely angry that this has arisen. I do not understand how this has happened. My first question goes to Dr. Green, who spoke about quality assurance, but I didn't find in the presentation any detail on quality assurance. I do not understand, and I'm hoping that you can help me. I do not understand that it's moved from the norms and standards to the current framework, but I do not understand what will give us the confidence that the outcomes ultimately will be any different from what they were before. You spoke about the formal guidance in terms of program, packaging, etc., but I hope that you can explain how we can have an increased level of confidence. To Dr. Taylor, We have in South Africa an anomalous situation with respect to our educators. We have the South African Council of Educators, which has absolutely no say, and in the current form it shouldn't have, but it has no say over the training of educators, the initial training of educators. What we would like to see is that before, in an ideal world, if the South African Council of Educators was structured differently, that before it registers teachers, it does a competence test on teachers. So teachers have to be found to be competent, and every university must produce teachers that are found to be competent, obviously by a well-structured test. I'm interested in Dr. Taylor's response to that, Jay. Chair, I just would like to clarify with Dr. Green, on page 5, which is where he is applying the model of teacher supply and demand. And I hope it's a more complex model, because this is a very simplistic one, not taking into account various phases, focus areas, etc. But when he's applying the model, it says pragmatically to the national context. I just want to check on the numbers, because the second number there, the first number is the number of teachers in the pool. The second number is the number of new teachers coming into the pool. Now that number is 139,648. That number, if I have it correctly from the graphs preceding that that model, is actually a number of enrollments, not the number of graduates. The number of graduates would be approximately one quarter of that. So in fact, we will not end up, if I have my maths right, with any kind of surplus of teachers. We will in fact still have a shortage. But perhaps I've misread that. Chair, my last question is it relates to something Dr. Taylor said. He said, an effective reading pedagogy is the country's biggest need. I read a paper yesterday by a researcher called Elizabeth Pretorius, who talks about playing catch-up in grade 4, where no teaching of reading has taken place in grades 1 to 3. This ties in closely with the various international assessments and their findings. Okay, so if Dr. Taylor said that, why is that not informing everything that is being done? Here, you cannot do math literacy if you can't read. Why is that not informing everything? Why is it not informing continuous professional teacher development? Why is it not informing the National Education Collaboration Trust intervention? Everything that we do, and I must agree with Dr. Taylor, this is the country's most urgent need. How is the department going to ensure that it does inform every intervention? Thank you, Chair.
Love more. I just want to the following speakers, I don't want you to be angry. It will be understandable if you say you have a step so that we can together find a solution. That's why we are here. Thank you very much. Over to you, Ms. Van der Bart.
Thank you, Chair. To show that I'm disturbed and concerned, I won't be angry, but what I will say is to all the good teachers out there who do fulfill, thank you. But because we often, when you see these research documents, forget that they are good teachers teaching well, and we should not be overcome by the challenges, but the challenges are serious. And that's why always we sometimes forget about the good teachers out there who does know subject knowledge. I just want to make a comment, Chair. You know, I don't know what went wrong somewhere, but usually you go and study, then you go into practice, then you practice what you have learned. And it's true that in business and in teaching, that things change and you have to keep on being updated and every year you go on whatever. But in cases that I think is in this research and other research as well, is we find that people actually go to varsity, then they go into teaching, and then they have to be taught to teach. And I think that's what we've got to stop. You do not go into a job and then suddenly become trained in that job if you've been to university. I would also like to say that I think, and we've spoken about it at other forums, is that I think if you look at the statistics of the number of teachers, it's on page 4, that was presented to us, the enrollments and so forth, and projections, I think we have to, the department must seriously sit down and look at a screening process to make sure that on supply and demand, we only take in X number of teachers that we will need in specific subjects. You know, you get it when you study CA and other professions as well. It's not a free for all. First of all, that will, I think, bring better passionate subject teachers to the front, and I think it's a serious matter. It's been around for many years. Because we also have a passionate problem. And let's not forget the history of the country. Many of us want a job so that we can earn a salary. But the passion is lost somewhere along the line, and we must look at that. Chair, my last comment would be that seeing that we are talking about the training of teachers, and Funza Lushaka was mentioned, and I do understand that Funza Lushaka is meant for those critical subjects, etc., etc. I've written a question to the Minister, which the response came that she will not open the Funza Lushaka for Afrikaans teaching. Now, I think it's very wrong. And we have to, if you look at the history of last year and last year, is in Westernburg, in Polokwane as an example, in the Eastern Cape, Northern Cape, they ain't Afrikaans teachers. So are we now saying that it will never be a critical situation? Because I think we should promote all language teachers, especially also now see how we do on first English language, for example. I really think that Funza Lushaka, where we've seen a shortage, where children don't have teachers for Afrikaans, that we should allow them. It's going to become critical. And I don't think one language should be a barrier to any other language. Thank you, Chair.
Well, thank you, Ms. Van Raat. Ms. Boshoff?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I only have one question, seeing all the others have been asked. And this is directed to Dr. Green. It's a concern that we don't have specialist teachers for deaf, blind, mentally impaired. This is an infringement on their basic right, and it's going to add a burden to the economy, because what do we do eventually with these children, or if they are in a school and not taught properly? They are just going to rely on a social grant, and we need to really implement a system where these learners are also assisted. If you could tell me why you have completely ignored this side of the teaching, I would appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Boshoff. Stamkoni.
Thank you, Chairperson. I start with on applauding the department for the 20 years of good work they have been doing. Were from unqualified educators, underqualified educators, educators that have responded to get what they have today. It's because of the effort with speaking with the institution. That is a great job to be done from the apartheid regime. We know that we're working with the system where we inherited these educators. We cannot just shove them out and say, you do not have the skills. We have to try and uplift their skills. That's good. But at the same time, our researchers, the professors and professor and doctor. We have also to look at the good interdisciplinary measures. We will make a research on that to check whether are these taught or instilled when teachers are being taught or being trained. And also we look at the issue of the theory rigorous practice. You know, in the past, a matric student fresh from school would be able to teach another matric student pass. Why? They were focusing on the content of that particular subject. And a matric student will compete with a university graduate. A matric being above the graduate in terms of the output and results. A college teacher, you remember that time when we were at college, was powerful compared to the PA or whatever student. Why? The college student was doing more practice. Before school opened in January, they were going for practicals. In June, they were going for practicals. You see, the people in universities, they do it once, and maybe in 1 year or twice in 1 year, and then they have to go. Where is the contact of the learner and the teacher? We have to investigate that in this research. Because the contact should be continuous. If you are saying you want to be a teacher, you start right from the first year. You do your practicals up until your fourth year so that you are in contact. Because of the situation where we find a teacher away to face the kids in classroom, in the classroom situation. It's the first time and people have to run around, you see, disciplining teachers in behalf of kids in behalf of the teacher.
Mr. Mguni, if I may interrupt you, if you can shorten to the point, we're running out of time.
Thank you. I know that we have spoken about English, but there are these indigenous languages, so many. They have mentioned Afrikaans, we include this word, Venda, physically impaired. Please, let's make a research on those words, and then I thank you very much. At least I was short.
Thank you, Chairperson. I also want to thank the two departments for the efforts that you have taken to make sure that you are able to some introspect and even take action to try and correct the situation. I think a lot of issues that you raised, they are very interesting, and I think most of them require urgent attention. For me, it would be very important to know when are the important ones, the urgent ones, when are you going to start implementing them? Because I think that you will not achieve everything at a go, at a single go. So I think that there should be a plan of action of incremental starting to implement some of those activities. Particularly that now we have started a program of the Hunsan Shaka. So that is one area where you are going to be tested. You want to have enough defense. So the graduates of Hunsan Shaka should portray what the department wants. Everything that you desire in terms of the model teacher should be reflected in the form of Hunsan Shaka. I like in particular the part where you talked about convergence of education. I think it's one thing that is very key and needs urgent follow-up. And the issue of the funding of the practical part of training. I know that a lot of people have got resource problems with regard to that one. So I want to propose that even in the next budget, we must see that budget that relates to that aspect being properly allocated. If you go to universities, sometimes you find that there are faculties that do not have professors. And you know that at university level, if you have a professor is seen as somebody who has got the expected both practice and the theoretical knowledge of whatever that is dealing with. So I think I just wanted to check how does that interface with what you are talking about, because you can't expect to produce good quality teachers if you don't have properly qualified lecturers. If you rely only on the student assistants, student tutors, to teach other students, the second year student will be teaching the first year student. They don't have that expertise. It brings us to that point where we are saying that even though there is autonomy within the institution, there must be somewhere where we give guidance to the universities that these are the things that can happen, and these are things that cannot be allowed to happen. Because if you go to that level, we are still going to go back to that point of having teachers who are not properly taught to be able to impart the right knowledge to the children. Chairperson, I think I should end there in terms of my comments. Thank you.
Also over to you, Mr. Kekane. And then I now hand over to the chair.
Thanks, Chair. I want to also start with the practical part of teaching. In the research, it doesn't actually indicate how much quality do we lose by probably in the technical and vocational not having teachers that are exposed enough to practicals. But as in public sector, people can teach because they've never been exposed to practical experience in teaching, but not just in public sector, but also in industry. I mean, the only industrial revolution took place because of on-the-job training, where the owner is an owner, but also a teacher is teaching you, I mean, during the days of journeyman and apprenticeship. How much of that is taking place in this country? Is the whole industry which owns the economy exposing teachers, for engineers, for technicians, for artisans in their industry to real teaching, and people seeing what they've been told about in class, happening in real practice, even before they qualify. The research I wish had shown that definition of teaching. The second thing is just a worry that we're hoping that education and training will take Africa out of the darkness of preparedness and other development. Because we thought if we train our people and educate and train them, they'll use that knowledge to develop Africa. The first point is that in Africa, since the 1960s, the year of independence, up to today, most of the countries in Africa are still backward in terms of development. So what is wrong with the education? It's not just 20 years in South Africa. It is more than 50 years in Africa that after that the colonial regime and the relationship with developed countries, whether the dependency is underdeveloping Africa. But the worrying factor is that the analysis must show why we're not actually making headway anywhere in Africa. And actually those who started before us, who got independent before us, are worse off. So the problem is not just South Africa for 10 years. And we shouldn't be defensive or productive about education. I think we must be hard and critical about it. But these are the real factors that face us. And I wish the research could indicate why is that the case. Thanks, Chair.
Thank you so much for the question. I hope Dr. Taylor, you have seen that honorable members have moved beyond your report. We are now waiting for your report for the whole system, not only this phase that is just concentrated on. That is so much, how much eager our members want to know what is happening when it comes to the issues of education. But can quickly respond to the questions. I know we're running out of time. It's now one member that should go for plenary two. So if you can take just
10 to 15 minutes and we're done with it. Yeah, we'll get all the sponsors. Yeah. Can I start with you, Dr. Taylor? Then we'll end up with the Department of Safety decision. Thanks.
Thank you, Chair. That's good questions. Such a good debate. I think we're really onto a hot topic here, and obviously people are thinking about it. I won't answer all the questions in detail. A lot of it is supportive. A lot of it is overlapping in terms of things like the need to assess the practical part of teaching, the need to prioritize, the need to ensure quality, all of those things. Let me say something quite broad about all of that. Starting off with Honourable Ludmore's question about assessing students in practical situations and the role of SACE and the role of government regulation in that whole process. You know, we're not the only country in the world to face this problem. In fact, it's a worldwide problem. In some Brazilian countries, in some Brazilian states, being stymied by academic autonomy on the one hand, the states have resorted to certification tests. So they say to people coming out of the universities, okay, you guys have got your teaching qualifications, but if you want to teach in high school, you've got to pass this test. That's an understandable approach. I think that's the wrong approach, and I'll explain why. If you look at education systems around the world, there are a few that are the envy of the world, and we all know who they are. Finland, Singapore, Ontario in Canada, and one or two others. The rest, America, England, the whole lot are underperforming, like South Africa, actually. They share a lot of characteristics with the South African system. Now, what are the two broad kinds of characteristics of these two kinds of systems? In Finland, everyone wants to be a teacher. They select the top 10% from the schools. They interview them. They rigorously select them out. And throughout their courses, which gives them a master's degree, first of all in subject and in pedagogy, and all the way along leading people out. They only want the very best, the most committed people. America, like us, the low entrance qualifications or entry into teacher education faculties, because no one wants to be a teacher. They all go for something else first. How do we turn it around? From a high-quality professional system to a low-quality system where we try and resort to monitoring and punitive practices to regulate the system. And monitoring, colleagues, when monitoring is done through people who are not experts in the subject, it fails. It's a tick-box exercise. Our school all monitor reading. But you go and look at the kids' books, they're not near where that's the same they should be. So, you know, monitoring is a tick-box exercise if it's not carried out by professionals who know what they're doing. Now, what are the characteristics of a profession? And I'll be brief, although this is a big question. One, a professional body has a body of knowledge that guides practice. It's got a theory that guides practice. Think of medicine. Think of law. Think of accounting. Secondly, they've got protocols of practice derived from the theory. Thirdly, the protocols work in delivering a public service. Fourth, the professionals themselves guard the standards and they police them. The Engineering Council of South Africa last year told UCT that some of their secondary engineering courses are not up to scratch. And they said to them, you're going to get deregistered if you don't buck up. That's what a real profession does. Now, the Engineering Council of South Africa is a statutory body, but it's peopled by engineers, by the profession itself. Okay, what do we want to do now to get teaching onto that closer to being a profession? We don't have a body of knowledge. We don't have a theory to guide reading. We don't have protocols of practice derived from a theory. We don't know how to teach reading. And consequently, we've got no standards to police, so no one polices that. We've got to get the teacher education practitioners, the practitioners, excited about the idea of standards. We probably shouldn't call them standards yet because they're going to balk at that, but that's where we're going. We want them to, and I think we can incentivize them to research that. I think we should pump money. So I'm now saying it for the fourth time, into deriving a theory of reading that gives practical guide to an effective reading pedagogy. And those, yes, I agree, we should then assess our teachers in practice. Can they apply it in schools, in real time? Otherwise, they can't be certified.
Thank you, Chair. I just want to respond to a few of the points that was raised around Funda Lushaka. And I think, first of all, that as a nation, we can celebrate the Funda Lushaka Bursary Program. If one looks at what Dr. Green has presented in terms of the increase in supply, a large part of that can be awarded to as a result of the Funda Lushaka Bursary Program. It's not just a bursary program that provided students an opportunity to obtain a qualification, but around it is built a whole recruitment approach and information on the teaching profession and knowledge of the teaching profession have been provided and put out there in public. In 2013, we received more than 60,000 applications for about 4,000 bursaries that can be offered to new applicants. So the demand has grown considerably. And we realize and recognize, therefore, that in the light of this demand that is happening around Funda Lushaka and people that want to enter the teaching profession, we can become much more selective and raise our standards about who we award the bursary to and respond to the issues of shape that is required and something as highlighted by Dr. Green. We need to improve our tracking system. We have a tracking system in place. PASAL is providing a really good point of departure to see how after graduation students are employed and the progress that they make during employment. It's at the university level that we need to become much stronger. And we're working closely with the HEIs in order to ensure that we provide them the necessary support and ensure that we track students. And from the context of our country, Jefferson, we cannot just say we have not met the required standards, therefore we withdraw the bursary and it will be converted to a loan. In the context of our country, we also need to look at how do we support students and what are the role of the higher education sector, where a student is registered to support that student if they start to show difficulties, for example, in mathematics or in science during the BSc course. In order to address the issue of teacher recruitment in mathematics and science, we've realized in the last 3 years that we cannot just recruit at school level. Many learners at school level do not consider further studies in mathematics and science, or they will rather be attracted to medicine or in engineering and those areas. But there's a large pool of graduates that are not employed that have mathematics and science as part of their subject areas, or out-of-school youth who would like to now consider teaching in mathematics science as an option for them. So we are moving from just plainly looking at school level, but also looking at youth that is outside of the schooling system to recruit in those areas. The last area is the issue of selection at university. Universities do not do the selection of Funda Lushaka bursaries on their own. That process is guided and led by departments, and we do that in collaboration with the provincial education department. The district-based recruitment strategy that we use provides the department and the basic education sector with the opportunity to recruit students where there are pockets of shortages. So, for example, nationally, we have an oversupply of accounts teachers, but there are pockets in the country where there may be a shortage of teachers in Afrikaans or in other subject areas. And that is where we use the district-based recruitment, where the province can then say, in our particular province, we would like to recruit for Afrikaans. And the bursary program makes provision for that. Thank you, Chief.
Thank you so much for this discussion and the space that you've just had. We are saying education has been made an excess priority by our government, and you know exactly that at the heart of it is quality education that needs to be delivered. And Dr. Green, the country solely depends on higher education and making sure that those quality teachers
are produced for them to deliver quality education out there. So this is a relationship really that is very to basic education and higher education. It should always be there, but it's basic education. We really rely on higher education today. What is it that is put in there? To you, Dr. Taylor, we appreciate the report. We're still waiting for you to finish up, even with other areas that are still outstanding. We'll keep track on what you're doing, and surely we'll invite you to come back once you finalize your report. What is it?
Well, it's in stages, Jay.
Yes.
We will have something
details
next year, because
Okay. Definitely. We'll be very much happy to invite you to come back and share with us. There's so much that you are opening up. There's so much that you can work on from what you have said us in your Department of Basic Education, thank you so much. We know the effort that you are always putting in our education. We know the passion that we have in our education and the good relationship that we always have for Cultural Committee. Thank you so much to the Performer Committee on Higher Education. We enjoy sharing this platform with our elders. We are only basic education, so it was good to be in those institutions of higher learning today together with you. We really enjoyed it, and we know that not for the last time that we share the platform with you when it comes to the issues of national interest in education. So thank you ever so much to everyone for the meeting at the end.
Are you there for
MJ?
MJ?
Yes, I'm a student.
Where?
I'm in the University of Utah.
What is your study?
I'm doing my postgrad in international studies.
Good. Yeah.
Thank you.
You have our young students around doing things.
Actually, I learned so much from the committee meeting. And the funny thing is that I'm not South African national. So when
okay,
I come
where
here,
are you from?
I'm from Kenya.
I'm from Kenya.
Yeah. So it's a bit different, but I learned something every time that I study. Yes, yes.
I'm from July.
It's July.
What is it?